On April 26th, the Court of Appeals of New York, its state Supreme Court, heard oral arguments in a case in which a defendant who had pled guilty later claimed she was actually innocent. During those oral arguments, the Chief Justice of that court posed a hypothetical.
And I wanted
Counsel, let's talk about for a second newly discovered evidence in the context of this actual innocence claim for a person who has pled guilty. The guilty plea was constitutionally obtained. She was properly counseled. We're not talking about DNA evidence. Is there any hypothetical that you can think of where that person who develops newly discovered evidence after the guilty plea that proves that she is innocent would...
The legislature has identified a single instance, DNA. The legislature has...
Let's not talk about DNA. Let's talk about the person who is misidentified as the perpetrator of a crime. Based on that, he or she pleads guilty to the crime, is sentenced. And then 5 years later, someone comes forward and says, I was at my window, I videotaped the whole crime. You got the wrong guy. Here is the videotape of the actual person. What do we say to the person who pled guilty based on the misidentification and now is incarcerated?
In its opinion in the case, issued on June 18th, the court answered the question as follows. You tell her she's out of luck. That's right. In New York, a defendant who has pled guilty can have non-DNA evidence that 100% proves her innocence, and she won't be able to present it to a court. New York is not alone in this regard, and other states have laws stating that defendants who pled guilty can't even rely on DNA evidence to prove their innocence. So what's going on here, and how can you help make a difference? Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. And I'm joined by my colleague, Susan Simpson.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at the UFML2. You can also catch me and Rabia at our podcast, The 45th. The story of post-conviction exonerations can be traced all the way back to 1929, on the eve of the Great Depression. In February of that year, there was mob violence that came to be known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Here's a clip from History Pod talking about it.
On the 14th of February, 1929, seven men with connections to Chicago's North Side Gang were gunned down in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Although nobody was ever brought to trial for the murders, it's generally accepted that the attack was carried out on the orders of South Side Gang boss Al Capone.
The fact that the St. Valentine's Day Massacre was unsolved led to the creation of the Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory at Northwestern University. That lab caught the eye of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who was interested in fighting crime with science. Hoover had FBI special agents train at the lab, which led to the 1932 creation of the Criminology Laboratory at the FBI, and the creation of an entirely new discipline, forensic science, or the application of science to criminal investigations and prosecutions. That all makes it sound like the FBI was applying existing scientific standards and tests to criminal cases, but that would not be correct. FBI agents were instead creating new or first-generation scientific techniques and tests and using them to solve crimes. Think of fingerprints, handwriting analysis, and ballistics tests being used to determine whether a crime scene bullet was fired from a criminal's gun. These techniques, though, were not developed using the scientific method. Instead, Hoover and the public got the validation they needed when these techniques were used to solve a case that had gripped the nation.
25 years ago, the last chapter began in the tragic Lindbergh kidnapping. A police net closed in on Bruno Richard Hauptmann, ending a two-year hunt for a man who kidnapped and then killed the infant son of Charles Lindbergh. In Hauptmann's New York garage was found $14,000 in marked bills. Other damning evidence, an artist's sketch from a description by the ransom go-between. Handwriting specimens that definitely linked the Bronx carpenter with the crime. And written on a door, the phone number of Dr. Condon, the innocent agent who paid the ransom. Circumstantial evidence overwhelming in its impact.
With handwriting comparison working in the Lindbergh baby case, the FBI pushed forward with probably the most disastrous form of forensic science the country has ever seen: hair comparisons. Here's a clip from the New York Times piece, How DNA Changed the World of Forensics.
The police sent the hairs to the FBI's renowned crime lab. There, some of the nation's most experienced forensic scientists used high-powered microscopes to check more than a dozen characteristics, from pigment distribution to scale patterns, that told them whether a hair could have come from a suspect.
We would look at hairs all the time, every day. If you look at something every day, routinely, you get very good at noticing small differences.
Max Hauck would later join this elite unit of hair and fiber experts.
Some of the people that I worked with were fantastic. They had such a keen eye, such good discrimination. They saw things that I just didn't think you could see.
Hauck's initial inclination was right. These examiners were seeing things that couldn't be seen. But it wasn't until the late 80s that these errors would come to light. Here's another clip from the New York Times piece.
Scientists say they can take one hair from a crime scene, isolate its DNA, and match it with a sample from a suspect.
At the FBI, in one of the nation's foremost forensic laboratories, they are running extensive tests, determining how the agency can take advantage of the new technology.
By the mid-90s, hair examined under a microscope at the FBI was often sent for a DNA test. Hauck remembers one day early on when he got a DNA report on two hairs his unit had found to be microscopically indistinguishable. The results were jarring.
The hairs didn't come from the same individual. We started talking about, well, what did we see? Why did we think it did match? How good are we, in a sense? There's always that chance that you might be wrong. We never really knew what that chance was.
The double helix of DNA evidence soon became a double-edged sword for law enforcement. It would allow them to solve crimes with more precision, but it would also lay bare errors made in past prosecutions. On August 14, 1989, Gary Dodson became the first inmate exonerated through DNA evidence. Dodson had been convicted of raping a 16-year-old in Chicago's suburb in 1977, but DNA testing done in 1989 positively excluded Dodson and positively included the victim's ex-boyfriend as the source of semen recovered from her. There were actually two DNA exonerations in 1989, the second one involving a man named David Vasquez. In 1987, Susan Tucker had been raped and fatally strangled in her Arlington, Virginia home. The crime scene reminded investigators of some similar crimes, including one that had occurred in 1984. Here's a clip from the serial killer's documentary on the Timothy Wilson Spencer case.
As soon as they saw the way the body was with the ropes, they immediately thought of a homicide that had taken place 3 years earlier of Carolyn Hamm.
A local man was serving time for Caroline's murder. But with the similarities between the attacks difficult to ignore, detectives were now beginning to question whether the right man had been convicted.
Hamm had been found strangled, with her hands tied behind her with a Venetian blind cord. And the local man in prison for her murder was David Vasquez. Vasquez had a sub-70 IQ, and his interrogation in the case is reminiscent of the interrogation of Brendan Dassey in Making a Murderer. After hours of interrogation, Vasquez admitted to murdering Hamm, but when asked what he used to tie her hands behind her back, Vasquez responded, "The ropes." When told that ropes were not used, however, he answered, "My belt." Strike two. Vasquez then said that it must have been a coat hanger. Strike three. The police then asked if he remembered cutting and using the Venetian blind cord, and Vasquez answered that yes, he did. Vasquez also said he remembered grabbing a knife and stabbing Hamm before being told that Hamm had been strangled. Vasquez's response was, "Okay, so I hung her." Vasquez would later claim that his confession was involuntary, but facing the death penalty, he pled guilty to second-degree murder and burglary in exchange for a 20-year sentence. Of course, it turned out that Vasquez had falsely confessed to the murder. DNA evidence would later link Timothy Wilson Spencer to the Hamm case and other strangulation murders in Virginia, leading to him being dubbed the Southside Strangler and the first man convicted through DNA evidence. In turn, Vasquez became the second man exonerated by this new evidence. But it was actually a pre-DNA exoneration that had the biggest impact on shining a light on wrongful convictions.
The truth is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brushes on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. So what makes Quip different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads in a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They're on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. I'm one of those users. I used to use my brushes for too long and brush too hard. But ever since I changed to Quip, my dentist has said how my teeth are looking better than ever. And now you too can try Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/undisclosed right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/undisclosed. Spelled GETQUIP.com/undisclosed.
Here's Barry Scheck describing the origin of the Innocence Project to THNKR.
The Innocence Project was founded in 1992, and what we do is use DNA testing to get people out of jail who did not commit the crimes. It really began for us in a case 1987-88 involving an inmate named Marion Coakley, who was wrongfully convicted of a robbery rape in the Bronx. And in that case, we tried to use DNA testing. And this was before DNA testing was even in the courts. It was 1988. And there was not enough high molecular weight DNA to get a result. But we realized from that moment that this could be a transformative technology, and it would be able to exonerate a lot of innocent people, would be able to apprehend the real perpetrators, and it also would shine a window on what we believed were lots of wrongful convictions. My colleague Peter Neufeld and I, we actually knew from the very beginning that there were many, many more wrongfully convicted people than anybody believed, and that DNA could demonstrate it. We knew that.
But with the creation of the Innocence Project, a problem arose. DNA testing was done in the Vasquez case because law enforcement became convinced that another man had murdered him. But what about cases in which an inmate claims he was wrongfully convicted, but law enforcement believes in his guilt and has the only evidence that could prove his innocence? Here's Scheck describing the issue.
How big a problem is that? Just not only to find the evidence, but then that it's sitting around waiting for somebody to get to it.
Well, that's a very serious problem, and it's confounding because, you know, take sexual assault cases. And here in New York City, we had to work with the prosecutor's office, the police department, to get them to look at all these unsolved rape cases that were just piling up. So it's absolutely essential. As you wait to do DNA testing on an unsolved case, the real assailant can go out there and commit a lot of rapes and murders, because very often these are serial offenders. And when the cases are in backlog, you know, you can find that the same person committed more than one crime if you begin to test them. So
2 years after the Innocence Project was created, New York responded to this problem by passing the country's first post-conviction DNA testing statute. Under that law, if an inmate can meet certain statutory requirements, he is entitled to DNA testing to try to prove his innocence. By 2004, 31 other states and the federal government had passed similar statutes, and now, in 2018, every state in the country has a post-conviction DNA testing statute. But these statutes don't allow any inmate to get DNA testing. Instead, the inmate has to establish some likelihood that the testing will prove his innocence. Now, in some cases, this will be obvious, like in the David Vasquez case, where physical evidence was collected from the victim and the crime matches an alternate suspect's modus operandi. But what about when physical evidence is collected from a window that might have been used by a burglar or might have been left ajar by the homeowner? That's a closer call, and it would be within the court's discretion whether to grant testing or not. But there's another statutory hurdle in several other states that leaves no discretion for the court. A good illustration of this hurdle can be found in a case covered by an episode of True Crime by Aphrodite Jones.
In Dixmoor, Illinois, five young men have been convicted of Katresa Matthews' murder, even though the DNA found on her body doesn't belong to any of them. And pieces of the confessions in the case don't match. James was the alleged trigger man, and in the late 90s, he and his brother Jonathan began serving over 80 years in prison. They never confessed, but their three co-defendants did.
It took a long time for me to really try to understand why they did what they did. I just didn't sign nothing that I knew wasn't right.
They say for some people, pressure could either bust a pipe or it can make diamonds. You know, and it busts pipes on some of the people involved in our situation.
Specifically, the Dixmoor Five were a quintet of teenagers between the ages of 15 and 17 who were convicted of a rape and murder in Dixmoor, Illinois in 1991. Some of those defendants pleaded guilty, and some were convicted after trial. 20 years later, missing physical evidence from the victim was finally discovered and tested. It matched the DNA profile of a serial sex offender in the area. Now, in most states, this would have led to the immediate release of all the Dixmoor Five, but that wasn't the case here. In this clip, Tara Thompson of the Exoneration Project urges action from the district attorney in the case.
The DNA here not only excludes our clients, but it directs law enforcement to the true perpetrators. And in the overwhelming majority of similar situations across the country, when prosecutors have been confronted with this kind of evidence, they've acted swiftly to correct injustice. But that hasn't happened here. Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez has known about the DNA results in each of these cases since early this year, and yet the state's attorney's office continues to oppose their release.
To break that down, the members of the Dixmoor Five who were convicted after jury trials successfully moved to have their convictions thrown out based on the new DNA evidence. But the court found that that same relief was not available to the members of the five who'd pled guilty, finding that Illinois' post-conviction DNA statute only applied to inmates who were convicted after trial. So yeah, even though the DNA evidence conclusively proved that the pleading defendants were innocent and that another man was guilty, they were not entitled to relief. Now ultimately, in that case, Thompson was able to get the Cook County State Attorney's Office to move to dismiss the convictions of these innocent men. But this was not a result guaranteed under the statute. Now, however, it is, and that's largely due to a man named Philip McDowell. Years ago, McDowell, a Caucasian man, was charged with a 1989 murder and pled guilty to that crime after being in jail for 3 years. According to McDowell's interview with the Chicago Tribune, he entered his plea for a very specific reason.
The motion to withdraw the plea. I mean, the basis for my even pleading guilty in the first place was that I was beaten up by the Cook County jail guards that morning. So I felt I was in danger for myself. And I'd been in Cook County jail at that point for almost 3 years. And I'd seen plenty of assaults by guards. I've seen, you know, a number of things happen there. And I certainly believed that I was in danger. Mm-hmm. So I told Thomas O'Hara, get me out of here. The only thing they're going to take is a plea. I said, whatever, I'll do whatever they need.
And there is corroboration for McDowell's claim. Jail hospital records show that he was taken to the jail hospital that day to be treated for bruises and abrasions. As McDowell told Chicago Tribune, there's also reason to believe that DNA testing could prove his innocence.
We have a bunch of hairs, over 230 hairs, some of which are negroid hairs, so obviously that's a third person, you know, not me. We also have hairs that are consistent with each other, but different from myself. So that would indicate a third party. There are hairs in key locations, which is the victim's shirt, his pants, a towel that was close by. There's blood on the sheets. There's blood on this wash rag that was in the outside in the parking lot, about 25 feet away from the door of the room. There's cigarette butts. There are beer bottles, and we've recently learned that they found extra fingerprints on these beer bottles that we didn't know about. There's three different beer bottles. They just told us that they were able to identify that. So there is indications. There's three different cigarette butts. There's three different types of beer bottles in there. And there are, at least on a Chicago Tribune newspaper, three different fingerprints. So there are some suggestions that there is a third party. Who that third party is what we're trying to accomplish through the DNA.
But McDowell faced the same situation that the pleading members of the Dixmoor Five had faced. Under Illinois law, pleading defendants were not able to seek post-conviction DNA testing. But as a result of cases like the Dixmoor Five and the McDowell case, recently in 2014, Illinois changed this law to allow pleading defendants to seek DNA testing.
It was denied.
But now you've got this new law, which the governor is supposed to sign.
It's correct. And it takes all those impediments away. Because at this point, the only impediment has been People versus O'Connell or the Illinois Supreme Court's interpretation of 116.3 to stop me, to say, no, just because you pled guilty, you can't get under any circumstance, regardless of who, the who, what, where, and when.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments, which can turn a great experience into an anxious one. That's why Quicken Loans created their exclusive power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, assets, and credit to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, making your offer more attractive to sellers. Once verified, you qualify for their exclusive rate shield approval. They'll lock your interest rate for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then, once you've found the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep that new lower rate. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Rate shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. But there are at least four states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Arkansas, that still have laws or court opinions that specifically state that defendants who pled guilty can't seek DNA testing. Take the case of Elwin Graham out of Arkansas. In 1996, he pled guilty to capital murder and later sought DNA testing of a hair found at the crime scene. According to Graham, first, he had maintained his innocence both before and after his plea, and second, he had pled guilty due to a history of mental illness and because of a statement by a fellow inmate that implicated him, with that inmate later recanting and saying he snitched only in exchange for the prosecutor dropping two other criminal charges against him. The Supreme Court of Arkansas's response? None of this matters because the state's DNA statute does not allow those who pled guilty to seek DNA testing. Now, in addition to the four states that preclude pleading defendants from seeking DNA testing, Kentucky only allows pleading defendants in capital cases to seek such testing. So if an African-American defendant in Louisville pleads guilty to second-degree murder and gets life without parole, he wouldn't be able to get DNA testing of a Caucasian hair found at the crime scene. Now, you might think the only four or five states preventing pleading defendants from seeking DNA testing isn't that big of a deal, but it's important to note that many other states could reach similar conclusions in the next few years. Only Ohio has a statute that specifically precludes pleading defendants from seeking DNA testing. Some of the other states have statutes that only allow DNA testing when identity was at issue at trial, and the other states allow DNA testing only when there's some likelihood that the results of such testing would have produced a different outcome at trial. And so you can probably guess how the courts in these states have ruled. In the states requiring that identity be at issue, courts have held that identity was not an issue if the defendant pled guilty. And in the states requiring proof that DNA testing would have produced a different outcome at trial, courts have held that this is an impossibility in cases of a guilty plea because there was no trial. There are at least a dozen other states with similar statutes that have not yet ruled on this issue, and it's easy to see them reaching similar conclusions. Of course, there's one way to stop this, and this takes us back to the case from the introduction, which also widens the scope of the problem.
Until recently, New York did not allow pleading defendants to seek post-conviction DNA testing. A few years ago, however, New York got rid of this law. But like many other states, New York also allows defendants to file petitions for writs of actual innocence based upon non-DNA evidence of innocence. Let's say that the state's key witness recants, or missing surveillance footage finally surfaces showing that someone 100 pounds heavier than the defendant committed the crime. Under New York's law, a defendant found guilty after trial could submit that evidence in a petition for a writ of actual innocence. But what about the defendant who pled guilty? This takes us to the case of Natasha Tiger, which you heard about in the opening of this episode. Tiger is a licensed practical nurse hired to take care of a disabled 10-year-old girl who suffered burns that were allegedly the result of a hot bath that Tiger had given her. Faced with 7 different charges, Tiger later pleaded guilty to 1 lesser-included offense. When the girl's parents later sued Tiger, she retained an expert who concluded that the care rendered by Tiger was not a substantial cause of the girl's injuries, and the civil jury unanimously sided with Tiger. So when Tiger later sought to present this expert's testimony as part of a petition for writ of actual innocence, the court found she couldn't because she'd pled guilty. This later led to her attorney making an impassioned argument before the Court of Appeals of New York.
But if we accept the premise, and I go back to my initial assessment, if we accept the premise that innocent people falsely confess to crimes that they did not commit, and even the DA concedes that in their reply brief, we also have to accept the premise that those very same factually innocent people falsely admit their guilt to crimes that they did not commit. And if that happens...
Yes, but isn't her whole argument here that the reason for that is because of the ineffectiveness of her lawyer? Isn't that really, when you drill down, that's why she says, I ended up taking this plea?
She took the plea because of her advice of her attorney, yes, but also because she was unaware of the existence of a pathology report taken from this child at Westchester.
But doesn't that track back to failures of her lawyer?
Indeed, it does, but it doesn't have to be completely married with that.
This is an interesting back and forth, and it relates to the recent opinion of the United States Supreme Court in a case known as Missouri versus Fry. In Fry, the defendant's attorney failed to tell him about favorable plea bargains offered by the state, and the defendant ended up pleading guilty under less favorable terms. When Fry later claimed ineffective assistance of counsel, the state responded that such a claim only applies to trial performance and not performance in connection with a plea. The Supreme Court disagreed. Here's Justice Kennedy issuing the court's opinion.
In post-conviction proceedings in the Missouri State Court, Fry claimed ineffective assistance of counsel. He argued he would have accepted the prosecutor's offer of a plea bargain had he known about it. The state trial court denied the post-conviction motion, but the Missouri Court of Appeals reversed. This court granted certiorari. It is well established that criminal defendants have the right to effective assistance of counsel at critical stages of the prosecution. Among these critical stages is the consideration of a plea bargain offered by the state. Few would doubt that a defense attorney has a responsibility to tell his client about a prosecutor's formal offer of a plea bargain. So there seems to be agreement among the parties to this case that counsel's performance was deficient. But in arguing that relief should be denied, the state points out there is no right to a plea bargain. That's true. But it is also true that nearly 95% of convictions result from a plea bargain to a significant degree then. Today's criminal justice system is a system of plea bargains. And this court is unwilling to say that within that system, counsel's performance does not matter.
In Fry, the Supreme Court recognized the central role that plea bargaining has taken in the modern criminal justice system. And therefore, even defendants who pled guilty can now claim they received the ineffective assistance of counsel. But what about defendants who falsely pled guilty despite adequate or even extraordinary representation? On this podcast, we've covered many of the reasons why people plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit. They were the victim of mistaken eyewitness identification. They were the victim of faulty forensics. They gave a false confession after being subjected to the Reed technique. There were jailhouse snitches. Their public defender didn't have the time or the resources to devote to their case. Or, like in many cases, they were overcharged and offered a favorable plea bargain. In cases like these, when there is new non-DNA evidence of innocence, should the defendant be allowed to present it? This comment by one of the Court of Appeals justices foreshadowed how the court would ultimately rule.
That's a separate...
But counsel, this whole scheme goes to, you know, the newly discovered evidence builds in an after-trial provision, and part of that is because by pleading guilty, you give up a lot of rights in exchange for this deal. And now the government has a guilty plea, and you have whatever arrangement you've made in terms of the plea and the sentence. You can wait 5 years, 10 years. Government witnesses can die. They never had an opportunity to put their case on, and now you come in with what essentially, to me, seems like a freestanding do-over claim. Now I want my trial. And the government has never had a chance to put on their case, and 10 years later, you come in with, I have this pathology report, I have this civil testimony. And it seems the whole intent of 440 is to get away from that. So they do distinguish between pleas and guilty pleas and trials for that very reason. So in many ways, you give up many things when you plead guilty in order to get the benefit of the bargain. And that's reflected in this statute.
This is the same defense, really the only defense, that we've seen to these type of statutes. Two thoughts on it. First, why don't we apply a similar approach to Brady violations? As we've noted on this podcast, a Brady violation occurs when the state fails to disclose material exculpatory evidence to the defense. For instance, imagine that a defendant is convicted of a murder and, a decade or so later, learns that the state failed to turn over evidence that someone else actually confessed to the crime. Of course, the defendant's conviction can be thrown out, but if that happens, we still allow the state to re-prosecute the defendant for murder. So why doesn't the same concern apply here? In this hypothetical, 10 years ago at the time of the trial, the defense was not given the alternate suspect's confession to the crime, and so wasn't able to interview the suspect or to gather additional evidence. And now, here in the present, 10 years later, that hypothetical alternate suspect might be dead, and the evidence corroborating his confession might have been lost to time. So, if a defendant's guilty plea forecloses a later claim of actual innocence on fairness grounds, why shouldn't the same apply to state misconduct in the form of a Brady violation? Why in the world would a state like New York distinguish between DNA and non-DNA evidence of actual innocence? Sure, DNA evidence is great, albeit sometimes more problematic than we've been led to believe. But why allow a defendant to seek DNA evidence of a crime scene hair, but not allow a pleading defendant to present newly discovered evidence, such as surveillance footage of a taller suspect of a different race committing the crime at hand? And yet, New York is not alone in having this kind of dichotomy. Virginia allows defendants who pled guilty to seek post-conviction DNA testing, but does not allow those defendants to present new, non-DNA evidence of innocence. Take the case of Brandon James Clark, who entered an Alford plea in Virginia State Court based upon his alleged participation in a gang-related shooting. After Clark was convicted, eyewitnesses, including one of the two victims, averred that Clark was not the perpetrator of the shooting. If Clark had been convicted after a trial, he could have used these witness statements in a petition for a writ of actual innocence. But because he'd pled guilty instead, he was not entitled to relief.
So overall, how big of a problem are these types of laws? It's impossible to say how many men and women are in prison having evidence that could or does prove their innocence and yet who can't present it or have it tested because they pled guilty. But we do know the following. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, 149 men and women were exonerated in 2015. Of those 149, 65 had entered guilty pleas. So 44% of exonerees in 2015 had pled guilty, and more than one exoneree per week that year had previously pleaded guilty. So if you're in a state that doesn't allow inmates who pled guilty to seek DNA testing or present evidence of actual innocence, what can you do? Well, the main thing is to contact your local representative and ask him or her to sponsor a bill changing these laws. There's reason to believe that such a bill could get bipartisan support. Until recently, Maryland had laws preventing defendants who had pled guilty from seeking DNA testing and from filing petitions for writs of actual innocence based on new, non-DNA evidence. Earlier this year, however, there was a bill in Maryland to change both of these laws that was supported by testimony by Demetrius Smith. Smith had been convicted of one murder after a jury trial and convicted of a different shooting after an Alford plea. The conviction that resulted from the jury trial was later thrown out after the state found the real perpetrators. But the state fought Smith's attempt to have the shooting conviction undone after a key witness recanted and said he was pressured by detectives to implicate Smith. Smith testified in support of Maryland's bill, which ended up passing unanimously in the state house with only one no vote in the state senate. ProPublica covered Smith's release from prison.
So Michelle Nethercott, who was your original innocence attorney,
helped
you on
my lawyer.
Charges. It's a long day coming for you too.
Yes. Unfortunately, in the grand scheme of things, I know Demetrius hates to hear this, but unfortunately, many of my clients have been incarcerated for much longer periods of time. He's negotiated a lot of obstacles, and so I'm proud of him because he's kept his head high and worked and done the right thing. And I'm proud of you, Demetrius.
Thank you.
Are you going to celebrate today?
It's a regular day. I'm just happy.
Meanwhile, the Pennsylvania State Senate recently approved a similar bill, but it's unclear whether the bill will also clear the state house. If you live in Pennsylvania, be sure to call your state senator and ask him or her to vote in favor of the bill. And if you live in Michigan, Ohio, Arkansas, Kentucky, New York, Virginia, or any of the other states that limit the rights of pleading defendants to seek DNA testing or to present new non-DNA evidence of innocence, give a call to your state representative and let them know about the issue and why there should be a right to prove innocence after pleading guilty. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. We'll be back next Monday to tackle our next wrongful conviction case. It'll be a deep dive in one of our longer series focusing on why we think that another man was wrongfully convicted. I'd like to thank the following people for today's episode. Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer.